From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in the voting booth. This year is, of course, a presidential election year, and presidential contests tend to get most of the media attention. But there are many other races to consider, and governing at every level impacts our daily lives. That's why we invite candidates for prominent offices to join us on Connections before the election. Our goal is to bring candidates together to discuss the issues at length with one another and with our listening audience. Today marks the beginning of a series of conversations with the candidates. With the pandemic still burning, with Rochester in crisis following the death of Daniel Prude, with climate change and so many other challenges, our guests will have plenty to explore. Today, we welcome Jeremy Cooney, a Democrat running for New York State Senate. Cooney won a primary for his party's nomination. He's running for the Senate seat that has long been held by Republican Joe Robach, who is retiring. Cooney's opponent on the GOP side is Mike Berry, who unfortunately told us he would have to cancel his appearance today. Because the cancellation happened less than a day before the show, we offered Jeremy Cooney the opportunity to reschedule as well or keep his appearance on Connections as scheduled. Our hope is to find a different date before the election to get both the candidates on together, but today we do welcome Jeremy Cooney, candidate for New York State Senate in the 56th District. He is a former chief of staff for Rochester City Hall and a former aide to Congresswoman Louise Slaughter. Jeremy, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Evan. Great to be back.
A lot to talk about, and we have to start here in the city of Rochester. And I understand you're running for state office, and we'll talk in a moment about, you know, what the state role is when you look at what's happening in Rochester. But you are someone who has worked closely with a lot of people involved in what's going on here. And I know this past weekend you had a chance to be involved in a meeting with local leaders, just talking about next steps and where we are. How do you see, let's just start broadly, how do you see what's happening in Rochester following the death of Daniel Prude?
Well, I would say, as someone who grew up in this community and loves Rochester dearly, this is just a really sad time. Put the politics aside, it's not a good thing when the president of the United States of America is tweeting about problems in your hometown. And I'm very disturbed, as are many, by the death of Daniel Prude. I'm very much interested in kind of looking for solutions and how we move forward peacefully. I've been on the front lines. I've been talking with voters and citizens and neighbors about their feelings about what's happened here. But we cannot allow what happened to Daniel Prude to ever happen again, whether you're in Rochester or Monroe County or anywhere across this nation. If this is not a wake-up call, I don't know what it is. And this is, by the way, not new. This has been happening across the country, in the spotlight, certainly over the past year, but it's been happening for decades. And we need serious leaders who are willing to show up and have serious conversations about these issues, and who will, whether they're in the halls of Albany or whether they're here at local government in Rochester, are willing to take a stand and to make real policy changes to bring about what this community is looking for us to do.
Well, as you know, the Washington Post was reporting this weekend about calls for the mayor's resignation coming from a lot of different angles. You worked closely with the mayor. You know her well. Do you support those calls for her resignation?
You know, I did see that article. And again, these are really disturbing issues when you realize that this is our community that are being talked about in the national spotlight. I think whether you're the mayor or whether you're the governor, right, any elected official, their number one concern is making sure they are representing the people who put them into that office. It's about public trust. And look, the mayor won an election. She won her reelection. And only she can decide if she's able to accomplish her agenda, right? Whether that's criminal justice reform, whether that's education, whether that's making sure we're creating jobs. She alone can determine whether she has the trust of the public. And if she does, then she can continue to advance that agenda. I mean, look, we've got a mayoral election coming up just in a few months, hard to believe, in 2021. And so she's going to have to make that decision on whether she goes forward or not. What I can tell you is that I am absolutely laser focused on making sure that we're doing everything we can at the state level to support the local community here in Rochester and Monroe County, because whether you're Adam Bello or Lovely Warren, or whether you're a district attorney, they can't do it alone. They need help at the state level to resolve some of these issues that the community is demanding change for.
All right, let's talk about that specifically then. So if you're serving in state office, you're saying that they're going to have to lean on the state at least in some ways here. In what ways? How do you see the state having a role in this question on what reform might look like, or what's frankly, I mean, as others have said on this program, reform might not even be strong enough a word for what some are calling for regarding policing. What's the state role here?
So you mentioned, Evan, that I had a chance to meet with a group of leaders this weekend. What that meeting was, for your listeners, is under the leadership of Assemblymember-elect Damond Meeks and State Assemblyman Harry Bronson, they brought us together. When I say us, I mean any Democrat that will be on the ballot this fall. So from Joe Morelli at the congressional level to our county court judge and our Pittsburgh town justice, we all got together. And under the really powerful and thoughtful leadership of Pastor Myra Brown from Spiritus Christi, we had a conversation about what it looks like to govern with an eye to racial justice, knowing that there is a historical context for these types of discussions. I mean, the issues that we saw with Daniel Prude and what we're seeing across the country with George Floyd, so many others, too many others, are not new. And so we have to make sure that when we're going to Albany to govern, that we're not just doing what Donald Trump does and trying to govern by tweet, that we are really committed to having a serious conversation, knowing where we have been and then where we need to go. To answer your question more directly about what the state can do, Evan, my focus really when it comes to Daniel Prude is looking at the entire mental health service delivery system. So in New York State, we call what Joe Prude, the brother of Daniel Prude, when he called 911 looking for help, right? That's the key. He was calling for help for his brother. We call that a mental hygiene call or a mental hygiene arrest, which I think, by the way, is terrible language because it stigmatizes the person in need of services right from the get-go. But why is it that in 2020, when we understand the value of public health and mental health, why is it that we are sending a group of armed police officers to deal or to de-escalate that situation? That doesn't make any sense. Where are the mental health professionals? We are blessed in this community to have the University of Rochester. We have the University of Rochester crisis team. Why were they not brought into this conversation? So at the state level, if we want to make sure this type of mental health arrest never ends up the way it does again with Daniel Prude, then we need to make sure that we are funding resources to hire more mental health therapists and professionals to go with our law enforcement officers and to lead a de-escalation. You know, I was in a conversation with a voter just the other day, and we were talking about using the analogy of a bank heist, right? So picture, you know, a bank in downtown Rochester, someone comes in to rob it, right? And the alarm goes off and the police are summoned, right? You don't just send in the SWAT team, right? The RPD would show up and they would bring a hostage negotiator. Why? Because their role is to de-escalate the situation. Where was our de-escalation when it came to Daniel Prude? Where was someone to make sure that that man was not lying naked on a cold street pavement just blocks away from my apartment here in Rochester? Where was the humanity that was required and demanded in that position? I'm angry. And so many other of our neighbors and Rochesterians are angry. And we need that change to happen at the state level. Again, RPD or the Monroe County Sheriff's Department can't do it alone. We have to make sure that we are bringing the resources necessary back to our local law enforcement and police departments. And I will also say that right now, and we can get into this in just a moment, Evan, if your time allows, right now we don't have a seat in the room. Rochester is being left behind when it comes to other upstate communities or certainly New York City because we don't have a seat in the Democratic majority of the state Senate. This is why I started running 3 years ago, because I believe that Rochester needs to have a voice in the direction of New York State. And the protests that we're seeing happen every night are a reflection of a frustrated community that wants to have their voices be heard.
Okay, so you talk about bringing resources from New York State. One of the things we need to talk about this hour is the fact that this state doesn't really have resources to spare, nor do most states or municipalities because of the pandemic. So before we even get there, you're talking about resources for support, for, you know, perhaps social workers, for mental health workers to either aid or replace police on these calls. Who's paying for that and how?
So let's talk about the elephant in the room, which is the fact that New York State is struggling, like you said, so many other states across the country are too. This pandemic, and I'm talking about the coronavirus and COVID-19, has created what we're anticipating to be upwards of $13 billion or more in budget deficit for the state, right? Because, of course, of a lack of sales tax revenue and hotel revenues. And we're giving out a lot more in unemployment benefits, and we should be doing that. But you can't have a conversation about state resources because this is not just a New York State problem alone, right? This is an American problem. We need our representatives in Congress. We need our president to realize that New York State is an economic driver for the nation. And we need them to step up and to help us at the state level, which then, of course, trickles down to Monroe County and the city of Rochester, the area that I'm seeking to represent. So let's acknowledge first that this is really a federal problem. Now, you asked about where you get the money from, right? I have had the privilege and the experience to work in government over the last 15 years. I've worked at all levels, federal government. I've worked for two governors in the state of New York. I've worked, of course, as the chief of staff at City Hall. And I've prepared a number of budgets during those experiences. And what I can tell you is that budgets are a reflection of the priority of the citizens that we serve. So if we are prioritizing criminal justice reform or education or healthcare access or environmental, making sure that we are leaving this world a better place for the next generation. If we are saying that as elected officials or candidates for public office, that those are priorities, then we need to fund them, right? Budgets are a reflection of our priorities. And so if we say that mental health is a crisis in this country, then those resources should be dedicated to in our state budget. Let's not forget that, you know, we are one of the wealthiest states in the country. And I know that we're struggling because of high Medicaid costs and unexpected tax revenue, but there is still revenue coming into the state. It's just where we invest that revenue.
Okay, so how much is it going to cost to do what you're talking about?
Well, I think that's where we need to start by going to our partners in government, at the county and our city level. I think that's one of the things that I'm really excited about as someone who has relationships, obviously, with our mayor, but also with our new, I shouldn't say new, he's been there for over a year, our Democratic County executive who I grew up with, Adam, who's doing a terrific job. And so who can say to them, what do you need to be able to support the Sheriff's Department? What do you need to be able to support the Rochester Police Department or, you know, the Brighton Police Department, which is also part of the district that I serve, and the Greece Police Department, right? So, you know, these are the conversations that we need to be having now, Evan, so that when, if elected to office, that when we get to Albany in January, it's all about making sure that we have a seat at the table and that we can say, this is a priority for Rochester. This is what the community is looking for. And we are going to hold you, whomever the person is in office, hopefully us, accountable to making sure that you deliver those resources back home.
Okay. But the bottom line is, for now, you don't know how much it would cost.
No, we don't. Although we do have models to be able to look at, right? Again, I mentioned the University of Rochester crisis team. Right? They are already partnering with our RPD. We know that we have a number of local healthcare and mental health service organizations in the nonprofit sector, right? So we can anticipate that based on the data. If you look at, for example, I just had a call the other day with Goodwill, and they track all the 211 calls that come in across Monroe County. So they can tell you the number of mental health calls that are coming in currently right now. And if you extrapolate that by the number of staff we need, mental health professionals again, to sit in a police car and to make sure that they're showing up when our community needs them most, we can start to guess, or at least to prepare an estimate of what that cost will be, so that we can go to Albany and fight to put that into the state budget in just a few months.
Okay, talking to Jeremy Cooney, who's running for New York State Senate in the 56th District. JeremyCooney.com is his website. We invited his opponent. We had a commitment from both. The goal was to bring them both together today. His opponent canceled late in the process. We hope to bring them together perhaps next month before the election, because that's always the goal here on Connections. But Jeremy is with us this hour. And listeners, if you've got questions or comments, you can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. Connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Jeremy, Alex says, do we understand that even if reform moves forward on this, it could be years before actual changes are happening? Does that make sense to you?
I mean, yes and no. I think, this, of course, it's not going to be an easy solution, right? Change is always a difficult process. But there are some short-term things that we can do right now that are not going to take years to change, right? Whether that's recruitment of officers, whether that's mandated cultural training, whether that is an engagement of our clergy and making sure that we are much more connected to the issues of our community. Again, it depends what level of policing we're looking at, right? If you're looking at criminal justice reform as a whole, as a system-wide, of course, that's going to take some real conversations. I know you had former Mayor Johnson on your show last week talking about the work of the Race Commission, right? They're going to come up with some recommendations and some opportunities for community policing in our region. We've got the Police Accountability Board, right? Now they're going to be having some dialogues about this. And of course, we're seeing city council step up in a real way. And I'm really proud of the leadership that City Council has started to show on issues of community policing and transparency in our government, right? They're going to need partners like myself who can go to Albany and say, this community wants this type of change. Now, I think you had on your show a couple of months ago, geez, it's hard to believe it's already past Labor Day here, that you had a dialogue with folks talking about the governor's, Governor Cuomo's, mandate that each police department have these types of tough conversations about what policing looks like for their community, right? And he incentivized that financially, right? So that always gets the wheels turning. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see how that ends up. I've been to a couple of the listening sessions that took place in Brighton and one that took place in Hilton, both part of the 56th Senate District. But I'd like to kind of hear what the community, what the citizens are looking for. I made it very clear that, you know, if elected to serve, we're not going to Albany to just tow the same old line that's been towed for too long. We have a responsibility as a next generation leader to bring the voices that have gone unheard for too long for these systemic levels of changes. So when Alex said it's going to take a long time, yeah, it's not going to happen overnight. But I think we can do some real positive changes. Again, let's put a mental health counselor or therapist in the squad car with a police officer so that they're not just going to a door and not having a skilled professional to help de-escalate the situation so we don't end up in this matter again.
All right, let me get William in Rochester on the phone first. Go ahead, William. You're on with Jeremy Cooney.
Hey, how you doing?
Good,
anyway,
sir.
I'm going to mention a couple things, if I may. I'm so tired of the lip service from both sides. You know, they talk things that they're going to do, but things that actually never really get done. Yeah, as you know, the Democrats, all they've done for the American people is go after President Trump for what? His whole presidency. Really, what have they done for the people, you know?
No, I mean, a lot actually gets done in government, even when Republicans are in charge and when Democrats are in charge. I don't really understand the idea that nothing. Yeah, Republicans are doing a lot and Democrats do a lot.
Yeah, they're doing a lot, but they never ask the American people what they think. With all these executive orders from governors and states are running amok as far as I'm concerned. But there is one other thing I'd like to mention. about the COVID. It's killed about 200,000 people as of now.
Mm-hmm.
John Hopkins did a study in 2018 and found that between 250,000 and 450,000 die each year in America from medical and doctor mistakes. Now, that's a study from John Hopkins, just 2018, and it just makes me wonder, why the big outcry with COVID when this happens to the American people every year?
You know, you realize that 200,000 number could be 2 million if we didn't make the changes we're trying to make. Do you understand that, William?
Yes, but the changes haven't come, is what I'm saying. How long has this been going on? And this, between 250,000 and 400,000 are the ones they know about.
Yeah, I mean, William, I appreciate the phone call, and I'm trying to be kind here. Look, 200,000 people roughly have died from COVID in this country that have been officially counted. When you look at excess death rates, it's significantly higher than that. It's probably a 250,000 to 300,000 so far, okay? And we're not ever going to get a perfect accurate count, but that is an unbelievably high number. The United States per million is in the top 10 in the world. Tomorrow, we're going to pass Italy. Remember all that talk about Italy? Took us 6 months, but we're going to pass Italy in a per million death count from COVID-19, even though we had all that extra time and resources to prepare. We've passed France. We are going to be passing others. Brazil is on our tail. And that's not something that you want to hear. This is not a good competition to be leading in. And we had more time than almost everybody. 200,000 people dead. I do not, frankly, care if there's some other affliction where 300,000 died. That doesn't make me think that the people who died from COVID don't count. It also doesn't make me think that we should scare everybody into never leaving their house. I've been out to restaurants. I've done my best to be as active as I can. But William, the notion that that COVID is somehow overblown, unfortunately, we've underblown it because we shouldn't be at 200,000 dead. It should make you angry. And if this sounds editorializing, I don't get it. It's not partisan at all. I'm selfish. I don't want my mother to get COVID. I don't want my stepfather, my dad. I don't want them to get COVID. The outcome is going to be very bad if that happens. That's a selfish thing. But we should not be sitting here thinking that, you know, well, COVID's only 200,000. What number becomes significant enough for us? On the subject of whether things get done in government, well, things get done when parties have control. The Republicans have been doing quite a lot. The Democrats did quite a lot. They passed a health care plan that some people like, some people don't. When they had power last, Republicans have done quite a bit. So it's the idea that nothing gets done or the public doesn't care. Now, there is the idea that executive orders are a problem. And I understand that. And President Obama did a lot of that. And Democrats shouldn't be surprised when President Trump comes in and he starts using executive orders. Democrats were doing it. The standard has to be the same. If you don't like it, you know, and your team uses it, guess what's going to happen when the other team gets in power? So I take that point very much so. But I'm not really sure of the rest of it here. And I'm sorry I'm getting kind of heated, but we're about to hit 200,000 dead with COVID, and that's very serious to me. We're about to go into a winter in which we got to really figure out how to make this work as a country. And our numbers should be much lower than they are. And they are not. And that is not okay with me. Okay, Jeremy Cooney, go ahead.
Every morning, I worry that the person I love most in this world, Diane, who goes and serves in our hospitals as a healthcare provider, whether she's at Strong or whether she's on the Finger Lakes, she sees people who are, perhaps this COVID-19 has exposed the health inequities like nothing else in this nation and in this community. And she is on the front lines serving these people. And, you know, we're doing everything we can. We're wearing masks. We're getting tested. We're staying safe. You know, we wanted to go on a vacation this summer. We ended up driving in our car up to the Adirondacks and getting in a kayak in the middle of the lake so that we were socially distant, but we still got some time away. You know, these are the choices that we are making so that we can live a safe in a safe way. but I refuse to let the COVID 19 pandemic, impact and fall and victimize the most vulnerable populations in our state, our older adults and our children.
Okay,
we have to make sure that William, you talked about lip service. There's a lot of people who talk about healthcare being important, but right now we know that kids are making a very difficult choice for their parents or their guardians between going to a wellness visit, seeing their pediatrician, or putting food on the table. And we just did a roundtable 2 weeks ago with a group of senior citizens right here in Rochester who cannot afford prescription drugs, and they are underdosing because they can't afford the full dose that their doctor told them to take, right? So that's all tied into healthcare access. I believe healthcare is a human right. And you know where those decisions are made? Yes, of course, they're made at the federal government, but they're also made right here in the state of New York. And if we as a community, and I'm listening to a lot of people, I'm talking to a lot of people, you know, unfortunately, most of it's by phone these days because I can't safely knock at your door like I did in 2018. But when I talk to people, they say healthcare access is my number one concern. And as a person who is very much involved with patient care from the eyes of my better half, I cannot go to bed at night knowing that I'm not doing everything I can to make sure that we make healthcare more accessible in the state of New York.
Well, that's an idea that I think a lot of people have, Jeremy, and let's come back to that, because after our only break of the hour, it's one thing to say you want to make healthcare accessible. You got to describe how you want to do it. We also have to talk about how we're going to continue to address the fact that this pandemic has impacted what states and municipalities have to work with. Now, the candidate on this program, Jeremy Cooney, said that, yes, he agrees with Governor Cuomo and a lot of governors that the federal government has to make sure states don't fall apart here. There's massive holes to fill. But if Joe Biden doesn't get elected, Jeremy Cooney's idea might fall short there. And I don't know what you do at that point. I don't think he's saying his only plan is to have Joe Biden get elected, but let's talk more about that. And I also want to say, William, I'm sorry I just got fired up about COVID. It's not good form. I do respect your concerns, but, you know, I'm sitting here with my 75-year-old mom's going back to work in a school despite my objections. I couldn't stop her, and I'm worried about her every day. She's in Ohio. This is a country that should be doing better than it is. It's just true. Canada had zero deaths this weekend. It's unbelievable where we are. We're right back with Jeremy Cooney, who's running for state senate. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about whether there should be fans in the stands at NFL games. And it's not just a conversation about COVID and risk of infection. Sports Illustrated regional writer Pete Smith says what happened in Kansas City last Thursday demonstrates that NFL fans don't deserve to be there. He's talking about the booing of the players who showed unity by linking arms. Well, what do you think? Should there be fans there? We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Elections don't just mean presidential elections. And in November, there are a lot of races on the ballot. And our goal is to bring the candidates together to have conversations on this program with you and with us. Today, we've got Jeremy Cooney, who's running for New York State Senate. His opponent canceled late in the process with us. Jeremy decided to keep that appointment. We would love to get them together on this program, perhaps next month before the election. Always our goal. It's jeremycooney.com if you want more information about him on the issues. Now, there's a lot that sort of was covered in talking healthcare, state funding. So, Jeremy, to be fair here, you know, you're right in saying that a lot of governors, Republican and Democrat, are not happy that the federal government is going to let them sort of have these massive budget holes. And I've got a number of questions on that. If Joe Biden isn't elected and the president is reelected, which certainly could happen, my guess is we're going to see states have to figure this out on their own. And I don't think the only plan can be elect our guy. What plan do you have beyond that?
Well, let me start by saying this. You know, we hope that everyone votes on November 3rd and votes in a way that they feel safest, whether that's absentee ballot or another way, early voting or at the poll on Election Day. I often say to people that we can't control the politics of Washington, D.C., right? Upstate New York, Rochester, Monroe County will not be the deciding vote in the presidential election. But what we can do is we can stand up for the rights of New Yorkers. And what I mean by that is, if we send a voice to Albany who will show up, be accessible, and have serious conversations about the serious matters facing our state and our region, right here in the Finger Lakes region, we're going to be able to at least help people where we are right now. In terms of your question, Evan, I will say that one of the things that we can focus on in terms of closing our budget deficit, creating more of these services that we want to bring back to Rochester, there are some things on the state level that we have to be open to considering. One of that, of course, is legalizing marijuana, right? This is something that I talked about in my last campaign. We in New York have an opportunity to lead this nation with coming up with a plan that would not only legalize recreational marijuana, medicinal marijuana use is already permitted in the New York State, but also reinvest the dollars that is gained from the taxation of marijuana back into the communities that have been disproportionately affected by the war on drugs.
How do you do that?
And we know, there's legislation already in the state assembly. It needs to get to the Senate. Hopefully it comes as soon as January. That's my hope. But there is legislation that is written that would invest it back into communities of color predominantly. Let's be very direct and real about that. And I think when we talk about COVID-19, as your last caller just referred to, making sure that we have healthcare access, early screening, education funding, again, in these communities that have been left behind, so that we don't find ourselves in the same situation that we're in right now. I think the fight in Albany, truthfully, is about, you know, where does the money go, right? Everyone wants a piece of the pie. I get it. Where my head is on the issue is that Rochester, the city of Rochester in particular, has been left behind. And we need to make sure that our folks get their fair share of those resources, because it's going to happen. It's going to happen in New York. So let's be proactive and make sure that those dollars are being invested locally.
Many in your party want a super wealth tax that comes in a lot of different flavors. What would you vote for?
You know, I think just last week alone, Evan, you've heard Governor Cuomo start to recognize that, you know, revenue raises, from the ultra wealthy, the super wealthy, whatever you want to call them, down in New York City. He's kind of softened a little bit on that stance. And let's be very clear to your listeners. The people that would be affected or impacted by raising taxes or luxury taxes here, you know, on second homes and pied-à-terres and yachts and things like that. These aren't people like you and me, right? We're talking about the ultra wealthy, most of whom are downstate, the Mike Bloombergs of the world, right? Who choose to live in New York and have more money than they'll ever be able to spend in their lifetime. Right. Everyone in New York has to pay their fair share. And I'm sure as heck not going to let it fall on the backs of hardworking families and our children. That is something I'm very direct about. If you want, you can't tax your way out of a problem. OK. And I know that everyone likes to accuse Democrats of taxing their way out of problems. I'm not looking to raise property taxes on small business owners right here in Rochester that are barely surviving. You know, I just got my haircut this morning. It's a woman-owned business right in the city of Rochester. They're doing everything right. They've got all the PPE on. They got shields up, and they're making you wash your hands and temperature check when you walk in. That costs a fortune, and that's coming out of the revenue that they already lost, right? So to then add property taxes and sales taxes on top of that to them, they'd have to close. That's not right. We're looking to keep jobs, not lose jobs. So am I, to answer your question directly, because I do consider myself to be pretty transparent, would I support a tax on the ultra wealthy in New York City? Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it is about paying your fair share. Look, we can't have organizations like Amazon, right? I know this is more of a national issue, but the billion-dollar, trillion-dollar corporations who we all order from, especially during a pandemic. They've seen actually an increase in revenue, right? Get away with not paying any corporate taxes. This is ridiculous. This is not the America that we all have envisioned, or certainly not the New York or Rochester. Everyone has to pay their fair share.
Talking to Jeremy Cooney, running for state senate. What's a fair share look like? What's a rate or just an example of what a fair share is?
I don't think that there's a number, a flat number that, you know, has been even been proposed, truthfully. I think it's probably an increase of what we already have. I think we have to look at what the expected budget deficit is going to be. And we just don't have all the facts yet, Evan. We're still waiting to see what the third quarter is going to turn out to be in terms of loss of property and sales tax revenue. I've just read an article that some of our restaurants down in New York City are going to start reopening, and hotels. That's going to increase dollars to the state of New York. So I think we'll probably have a better picture of that going into the new year in December.
Okay. Talking to Jeremy Cooney about a number of issues at the state level, because in New York State, the state Senate has certain amounts of say on a number of issues that, as Jeremy pointed out earlier here, you still have to be able to work with local delegations. You have to be able to work with mayors, members of Congress at the federal level. His goal at the state Senate, and presumably his opponent as well, would be to have those kind of relationships, figure out what people want and need, and bring it back there. Now, in this community, what people have been saying this year is the Rochester City School District ought to be taken off the cut list. Here's what I mean by that, and I'm curious to know if you agree. Governor Cuomo has said that if there is not help from the federal government during this pandemic, we're looking at 20% across the board in New York State just to deal with the lack of revenue. 20% across the board, 20% to Rochester City School District in funding could mean hundreds more teachers after a devastating previous 18 months. It could be remarkably disruptive for a district that doesn't really have anything left that it feels like it could cut. And there are those who say, look, you're right, you have to cut from somewhere. That should be off the table. At this point, RCSD should be off the table. Should it be off the table, Jeremy?
As a son of a public school teacher, as a graduate of the Rochester City School District, I am a huge believer in high-quality public education for every child. And when you talk about additional cuts, that's unfathomable. To me, education, high quality education begins with fair and adequate funding for our schools. You know, one zip code should not determine the educational outcome of a child. And that's the reality, not just in New York State, but in Monroe County. Let's be very direct about that. And this is not just RCSD, by the way. I've been proud to be endorsed by the teachers union across New York, and it's NYSET. I've had conversations with teachers and administrators and parents all across the 56th district. So in the district I'm running in, you've got school districts like Brighton and Brockport, which in 2019 didn't pass their school budgets on the first run because they are way underfunded by the state formula. But forget about the, you know, almost $90 million that's owed to RCSD, right? I mean, these are real problems. And Rochester is getting left behind. I want to bring this point up because I think this puts context into our conversation today, Evan, which is that in the state of New York, in the state Senate, there are 63 state senators. After 2018, when the Senate flipped to the Democratic control, 40 of those 63 senators are in the Democratic Party. Of those 40 Democratic majority state senators, there are only essentially three in upstate New York. And what I mean by that is there's Senator Breslin in Albany, there's Senator May to our east in the Onondaga County and in Syracuse region, and then Senator Kennedy in Buffalo to our west. That's it. Rochester is missing from that group. We don't have a seat at the table. And so when you're talking about RCSD or you're talking about public school funding overall, we don't have an effective advocate to make sure that our kids and our students and our parents are receiving the resources that they need. This is a problem that is not new. This started way before 2018. And I feel very passionate about this issue because, you know, I'm a graduate. If elected, I'll be the only graduate of the Rochester City School District to sit in the Senate. But Diane and I both live in the city, so we want to send our kids to great public schools.
But can you really make the argument, Jeremy, that, if there's a majority in the Senate, or if you're running the Assembly, if there's a majority in the Assembly, you got to elect that party? I mean, can't you be a Republican in the state Senate and still be an advocate, or you still be in touch with issues, or still represent people effectively?
I love the musical Hamilton, and there's a great song about being in the room where it happened, right? If you are a Republican in the state Senate, you can try your hardest, but you are not going to be in the room where it happened. And you need to be in that room if you want to fight for the resources. I mean, let me give a very specific example on an issue which a lot of folks in Rochester care about, which is transportation. You know, I represent a part of the district that goes from way up in Hamlin all the way through the city of Rochester to over to Brighton. And so in 2019, in the last budget negotiation, Senator May, in the Democratic majority, secured $70 million in transportation funding for her community. Senator Kennedy, who is now the chair of the Transportation Committee in the Senate Democratic majority in Buffalo, secured $100 million for his community. Rochester, represented by six Republican state senators, including Senator Robach, who's retiring, stayed flat. Look at the numbers. I mean, that's the reality. And we can, you know, watch all of these great episodes of The West Wing and fantasize about democracy. And, you know, I love that. But when it comes to bringing back resources for our beloved Rochester, we need to have a seat at the table. And that's why we're in this race.
All right. When we look at funding, I got another question in a moment from a listener via email. But generally speaking, do you feel that the way you want to move money around to cover, whether it's mental health resources, more training, more support for police, RPD, et cetera, or whether it's for protecting funding for RCSD, no matter what happens with COVID and the pandemic and the next election, or whether it's some of your other priorities, healthcare and beyond. Generally speaking, do you think we've got to reprioritize the money and make cuts in some places and put the money where I'd like it to go? Or do you think we've got to have new streams of revenue?
I think it's an and statement. I think it's both.
So where's the waste? Where do you want to cut from?
Well, you know, I mentioned before that I had the opportunity to work in City Hall, and our deputy mayor at the time was Len Reedon, who worked at Kodak for many years and was a great community leader. We lost him to cancer, unfortunately, a few years ago. And I was a young chief of staff, and I was, you know, always wanting to do this new program or this new initiative, right? And I remember Deputy Mayor Reedon pulling me aside and said, Jeremy, we can do all of that. But at some point, what are you going to stop doing in order to do what you and the mayor are seeking to do? And that really stuck with me. We don't often have that type of conversation in Albany, you know, in terms of, hey, you're prioritizing mental health therapists. Great. What are we going to cut to be able to do that? What I can tell you is I believe in government. I've worked in government. There's a lot of good people who work in government, but I am of a generation that believes that government can be more efficient, can work smarter. I use data. I think that's probably one of the reasons why I have the support of Andrew Yang, for example, is because I believe in using data to inform public policy making decisions. And we have to stop doing things that don't have positive outcomes. There are programs that we have been operating in New York State, and I'm not going to give a specific one because I don't want to call out one, but that have been operating in New York State since the 1980s that is not producing the results that we want. So what could we do differently to make it either an obsolete program and do some of the things that we just talked about, or how could we improve it? And, you know, government, we have to realize that every single tax dollar is precious. Especially, as you noted, Evan, already in a very challenging financial environment. So we need to make sure that there is as close to zero waste as possible. Very tough thing to do in government, by the way. But we have to be hawks when it comes to our budget. We have to make sure that we are being responsible, because every family, whether you're an ultra millionaire, billionaire in New York City, or whether you're a hardworking family right here in Rochester, we need to earn their trust, and we need to make sure that they feel that we are serving their best interests.
All right, we're going to try to squeeze in as much as we can in the next 5 minutes. Briefly here, I'm curious to know, I don't always accept the right-left paradigm in politics, but looking at through that lens, what's one major issue that over the years you found yourself moving either right or left on?
I think probably healthcare. You know, I definitely was probably more educated and informed about the lack of healthcare access right here in Rochester over the past 3 years. So where I probably was a little bit more conservative on, I'm probably a little more liberal on. Look, I'm not saying I have the perfect legislation, you know, that I already have written up and made my mind up about. But what I can tell you is sitting on our hands and doing nothing is unacceptable to me. And that's what's been happening, right? I mean, prescription drug costs is not a new conversation. I mean, Louise Slaughter talked about that when I worked for her, right? And that was a lot of years ago. And so what are we going to do differently about that? And so that's why I've been more open, I think, to, you know, healthcare reform and healthcare conversations in New York. And I think we're going to have those tough conversations, because that ultimately is going to have the biggest impact long term on the financial stability of our state.
All right, David and Henrietta on the phone next with Jeremy Cooney. Go ahead, David.
Thank you. Jeremy, you mentioned a few minutes ago about everyone must pay their fair share, you know, in taxation, and there's a lack of resources currently. The issue that's always bothered me is that it isn't a fair game here in New York State, because tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people get income tax immunity when they retire because they work for the public. To me, that's crazy. I looked this up and can't find any evidence that this was ever voted on by the public. So in other words, this is something that public employees gave to themselves, this immunity when they retired. So we who have to pay the taxes are, and there is a subtraction in our, you know, in the tax that's due, but for retirees. But I mean, it's still not easy. And why we should have to subsidize people literally right to the grave, when we've been paying all of their salaries, benefits, and pensions for all of their lives, I think is ridiculous. And the point is that we were never given the chance to vote on it.
All right, let's let Jeremy respond. Thank you, David. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Well, thank you, David. And I think I understand the question. And I can only relate it to my own family. I mentioned my mom was a public school teacher. She taught at Monroe Community College for 35 years. Unfortunately, I lost her a few years ago to cancer. But my mom, you know, she worked hard. She didn't make a lot of money, but she did earn a pension, a state pension, that did not get taxed at the state level, although it was taxed at the federal level. So I think that might be part of what, David, you were referring to. Look, I believe that for those who dedicate their lives to public service, they're never going to make as much money as the private sector is going to allow. But so that is an incentive for some folks to be able to commit themselves and serve our community in critical functions, whether it's law enforcement or teachers or municipal workers. You know, these are roles that we need to have to operate our community and our state. And I would support that. Now, in terms of the point about whether the voters have had a chance to vote on it, that's interesting. I am of a generation, again, that believes that we need to have more transparency in government, and that if there is going to be a major financial impact on the state of New York, then there should be conversations with voters and getting support and having a open hearing process on that. So let me look more into that issue so I can become more informed, David, but I appreciate the question.
Jeremy, 30 seconds. Ryan, who's a professor of history at SUNY Geneseo, says, please ask your guest about funding for higher ed. It is a driver of the state's economy, but it's often first on the chopping block at the state level. What will he do to protect funding for higher ed, particularly SUNY? Is that a priority for you, Jeremy?
Huge priority. Again, my mom was a SUNY professor. I grew up, she was a single parent, so I grew up crawling around MCC. So I do believe that higher education creates jobs and wealth and economic opportunity for families. We need to support SUNY and CUNY, which is our City of New York equivalent. I would fully support funding for those school systems. And they, by the way, what's happening at Brockport or Geneseo, these become economic drivers for everyone. So I would be very supportive of higher education funding.
I certainly know it is a seriously busy time for everybody, especially those running for office. And, you know, while we were disappointed your opponent canceled today, we certainly would like to try again. Would you come back on with your opponent before the election if we can make that happen?
Absolutely. Serious leaders show up for serious conversations, and that's what we're here to do.
Mike Berry is running on the GOP side, and we'll try to make that work. Jeremy Cooney has been our guest for the hour, a candidate for New York State Senate in the 56th District. JeremyCooney.com if you want to learn more. Appreciate the time. Thank you very much for being with us, Jeremy.
Thanks, Evan. Stay safe.
More connections coming up.